The Things We Must Never Forget, Studies in 2 Peter, Part 10. The topic tonight, we've got 29 minutes. Behold the severity and the mercy of God. I'm reading from 2 Peter 2, starting at verse 4 through verse 9. I didn't plan at all when I did Q&A last Sunday night that this would be the next text. It just happened, but it is interesting. 2 Peter 2, verse 4. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell, and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment, if he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with seven others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, if by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he condemned them to extinction, and then this phrase, making them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly. I didn't write that. I don't even like it. It's just what God's Word says. Verse 7, and if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. Then, if God did all those things, verse 9, the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and how to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. Verses 4 through 9 are really an extension, an expansion. It's too bad we've been away from it for a couple of weeks, but they really expand on the last phrase in verse 3, their condemnation, false teachers and those who listen to them. Their condemnation from long ago is not idle, and their destruction is not asleep. Now, Peter's telling these churches not to question the future judgment of those who give false teaching and those who embrace false teaching. He says to the church, now, you don't see judgment on them right now. Many times it's like that. People can turn from God, they can neglect God, they can ignore God, they can resist God, and it doesn't look like anything happens. That's the way it is in our world. And so Peter writes to these Christians, and they're experiencing their own share of persecution from ungodly people. So you can see where this is going to be on their mind. Here I am righteous, here you are wicked, you're persecuting me for my faith in Jesus, and God's not doing anything. How fair is that? And so Peter writes and says, they mustn't think that God's judgment, he uses the word idle, it's not idle and it's not asleep. God's judgment looks like it's idle. It looks like it's asleep. Peter admits that. We don't see people being judged at all. Not outwardly and not immediately. But there's another important issue behind Peter's words, and it has to do with how the church comes to think about false teaching in general. You can't help but think, that's a very strong passage. And you can't help but think Peter's doing everything in his power to prevent these Christians from adopting a mild view of something that God says is eternally damning. But Peter's worried that they might not think of it that way. They might not see it that way. And that's why I linked it up with that last part of verse 3 and that cluster of verses that deal with false teachers and their teaching and people who accept false teaching. Because we don't usually think that false beliefs are punishable. Bad deeds are punishable. We understand that God judges bad deeds. But we don't usually think of God as judging the false thinking that leads to those bad deeds. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Because he's not talking about just any kind of false teaching. He's not talking about people that might just make a mistake on some point of doctrine. That's not what Peter's talking about here. to our mind, bad deeds are bad deeds, but beliefs, well, beliefs are just, that's how our world works like that. You have your views, I have mine. Everyone's entitled to his, finish the sentence. Opinion. You can't condemn somebody for their belief. Aren't we all entitled to our own opinions? How can God hold people accountable for wrong ideas? That doesn't fit very well with our age at all. I mean, it just makes no sense to us. But Peter's already addressed this subject in chapter 1, verse 4, where he wrote, by which he has granted to us, talking about the revelation that we have, he's granted to us his precious and very great promises, so that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world because of deceitful desire. We took a whole week on those verses. So, here's what Peter's saying. Just as holding on to the promises of the Word brings freedom from corruption and evil desires, our desires play against the commands and promises of the Word. They're deceitful like that, Peter says. They feel right because there are desires. But Peter says, if you let those govern you instead of the Word, it's going to lead to just corruption. Everything's going to come apart. So just as holding on to the promises of the Word brings freedom from corruption, listening to false teaching brings bondage to the lusts of our hearts. So, this is what I was mentioning earlier. There's a particular kind of false teaching that's being highlighted here. There's a kind of false teaching that replaces knowable, revealed doctrine with the tolerance of a relativistic outlook that just makes moral absolutes disappear. There's a kind of teaching that says, you have your views, I have mine, and no one has the right to impose their values on anyone else. That's how our world lives. I use this illustration in my Christian ed class, so if you're here, I apologize. Let me just give you an example of how this works. And you know this is how it works. Let's pretend I phone Rogers. I phone Rogers Cable and I say, you know what, I don't like all the junk that's coming on my TV. Let's just say. And I'm watching stuff on there that is immoral. I'm tired of seeing everybody's anatomy all over the place and everybody hopping into bed with everyone else and lifestyles that I don't accept. It's bugging me. What are you doing? And you know what Rogers is going to say to me. You know right now what they're going to say. They're going to say, you know what, sir? If you don't like that stuff, that TV has a button. Don't watch it. Isn't that what they're going to say? That's exactly what they're going to say. And then I'm going to say, no. You don't understand what I'm saying. I'm not calling you because I'm offended at this. I'm calling you because nobody should be seeing this. And as soon as I say it, they're going to say, wait a minute. You don't have any right to impose your moral values on what other people want to watch on your TV. Isn't that what they're going to say? It's exactly what they're going to say. That's the kind of world we live in. There's a mindset that has captured all of us that says everyone is entitled to his own view and no one has absolutes anymore. And so when Peter talks about false teaching that leads to deceitful desires being fulfilled and the lusts of the flesh being fulfilled, he's talking about a particular kind. He doesn't mean somebody's got infralapsarianism figured out and someone has supralapsarianism figured out and all sorts of imponderable things. You're not going to be questioned on those things to get into heaven. No, Peter's talking about a particular mentality that says you can do what you want and there aren't consequences to it. Because after all, it's a tolerant world and God's open-minded. And so, we finally see the whole picture. we see why God holds us accountable for our rejection of revealed truth. Because bad teaching and bad deeds go together. And Peter says God will passionately judge both. The whole concept of God as judge, of course, it just rings archaic and foreign to our ears. And that's why, rather than speculate about how God might judge us in the future, he could do that. The Bible talks a lot about that. But Peter doesn't go there. Rather than speculate about how God will judge one day in the future, Peter says, okay, let's go the other way. Let's look back on actual deeds of history. Let's look back on things that we know have already happened. It's hard to argue with history. And he picks out three specific cases of God's judgment and he brings application of them. One, God judged the angels even though they were the highest creatures in his whole creation. That's in verse 4. For if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment, ... Just pause there. There's no missing the powerful confronting edge in Peter's words. He's arguing from the greater to the lesser. We know what the Bible says about angels, Psalm 8:5. You and I were made a little lower than the angels. Okay? So the angels were a step up, the crown, the shining glory of God's creation. But they sinned. And the way they sinned is significant to Peter's case. He doesn't just pick them at random. Here's how the angels sinned. They sinned by listening to someone else. They sinned by listening to Lucifer. And for that, Peter says, God cast them into hell. That's a quote. Cast them into hell. Now, Peter's carefully crafting his words to strike home with a very sharp point. Because we live in a day when almost nobody, Christians included, really thinks that God would cast anyone into hell for anything. That whole picture, the H word, has been pretty much wiped out from our minds by a world that only subscribes to a God who is kind of sweetly tolerant to all creatures, no matter what they happen to do. You know how the arguments go. It's very clever. And people, I've had them say it to me. And they'll say, certainly you're not saying God will send a person to hell for ... And then they put some single bad deed. So what are you saying, Pastor Don? You're not saying that God would send a person to hell for reading one dirty magazine, are you, Pastor Don? What are you going to say to them? You're not saying God's going to send me to hell because I told one lie. You're not saying God is going to send me for hell because I cheated on a test. And of course, well, no. We don't say that. We don't say that God sends a person to hell for just one bad word or one bad deed or the last thing you do before you die. I mean, you can craft those words like a lawyer. You can build the question in such a way that it has to get the kind of answer you're looking for. That's not hard. But you still have to come to terms with some hard scriptural statements. I mean, a lot of people apparently are going to be lost. Jesus said so. Matthew 7:13-14. Enter by the narrow gate. For the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Now, whatever you do with those verses, few are headed toward life, many are headed toward destruction. So how? Here's my question. Many. Few to life, many to destruction. How are they getting there? Well, they do bad things, Pastor Don. Okay, how many? Let me play the game now. How many bad things? If, as in those cleverly phrased questions I mentioned earlier, the answer isn't one bad thing, then how many? 4? 9? 17? How do we know where the line is? How do we know where it gets drawn? How many bad things did Adam and Eve do? Now, of course, in the ultimate sense, people don't go to hell just for doing bad things. They go for not responding to God's grace in Jesus Christ. I mean, God's made provision for the bad things people do, one bad thing or many. And the main point of our text today is people will never come to respond to Jesus. They will never humbly respond to that truth of the gospel unless they first come to believe that they are in serious peril as they are. I mean, you'll only come to Jesus if you see yourself in danger of judgment or in need of being redeemed. And it was that very message of judgment that was being downplayed, and it bothered Peter. It's sorely lacking in the church today, too. And that is why here, with one verse, Peter speaks of the highest order of created beings. They inhabit a realm of glory that's hidden from our eyes, but they listened to Lucifer in some way. We don't have the details. They believed a lie. They departed from the truth. They listened to false words. And Peter clearly says, here's what God did. He took them above us. And for sure, it says of the angels, God cast them into hell. Wow. And I'm just asking you the question. Does your mind have room for that picture of God? And if it doesn't, make room. Do you worship and serve a God who would never cast anyone into hell for anything? Because if that's the God you worship, it's a God of your own imagination. And so we read those words of Peter at the end of verse 3 about the damnation that comes through false teaching. Their condemnation from long ago is not idle. Their destruction is not asleep. Is God going to judge these people? Will they be judged for embracing error rather than truth? And Peter would say, well, look at the angels. We know what happened there. They've had a glory you've never dreamed of. They listened to Lucifer. God cast them into hell. Okay, Pastor Don, fine. You're talking about a world I know nothing about. You're talking about angels and demons and beings from another realm. I'm talking about ordinary people. I'm talking about the world we live in. Would God ever judge a world like that? Peter says, yes, in fact, he did. Point number 2. God judged the world for not listening to the message of Noah. That's in verse 5. If he, God, did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with 7 others, when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, ... Now, these words would have served Peter's purpose very well indeed, and that's why he chose this example. He's already said that when false teachers would arise, he said their message would be so tailored that the desires of the masses would follow them. Many will follow them, 2 Peter 2:2. Many will follow false teachers. What he means is it would be difficult to stay faithful to the truth when so many people turn away from it. That's always when it's hard to stick with the truth. It's always the case. And that's why Peter specifically mentions the account of Noah. He's very careful to remind us that out of all the people on the earth, only 8 were saved. Tiny percentage. And remember, Noah had to wait for the fulfillment of God's message of judgment from when he heard it to when it came. Do you know how long? 120 years. 120 years. Everybody laughed. 120 years. Nobody listened to what Noah said. 120 years. But Peter's point is all those people, they weren't safe just because they were in the majority. The crowd was wrong. And the whole world was judged except for Noah, seven others. Eight people. What an important reminder for us today. Both Peter and Jesus retold the story of Noah a number of times. It's one of those very old accounts that just slaps current worldly mindedness in the face. It does so because it comes in the same way the gospel message comes, with this reminder that mankind will only find safety from the wrath of God in Jesus Christ. There was only one way to escape then. Most people didn't believe it. There's only one way to escape now. Most people still don't believe it. And then the New Testament says, okay, remember Noah. God had Noah build the ark. Out of all of the inhabitants of the earth, only eight people took God seriously enough, the truth. God judged the rest. When you're tempted to think the crowd may be right, when the fact that the majority of people around you, maybe even in church, the majority of people around you drift from what you see to be God's call on your life. Oh man, I'd like to get every young person. Not because you're more gullible, I don't mean that at all, but because your life, my life, you know, it's a lot of it's done. But your life's still being shaped. It's still being made into something that God can use for greatness. And if I could instill in every person here that's under 30, get it through your head right now that many, 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 many times the crowd is wrong, and if you're going to follow Jesus, you can't go with the majority. They're not safe. Point number three. There are specific acts of judgment that are left as warnings to the ungodly and so must be preached by the church. Like we're doing tonight. This has to happen, Peter says. Verse 6. If by turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to ashes, he condemned them to extinction, making them an example of what is going to happen to the ungodly. Making them an example. Well, if you make something an example, then you want people to know about it. Otherwise, it's not an example. There must be some people in this room tonight who are wondering, why do we have to give all this attention to these dark passages of judgment? Why do we have to rehearse and proclaim the sternness of God from ages past? And Peter tells us why. He says we must teach these things because God left them as warnings to careless, godless people in our day. He doesn't want these lessons forgotten. Oh, it would be way easier not to speak of Sodom and Gomorrah. It would be more comfortable not even to think of them. But God says you have to. You have to. It's His wrath that makes His grace and mercy precious, where wrath and mercy meet in the atonement. People will never cling to Jesus until they sense they're lost and headed toward damnation. Oh, they may come to Jesus to get out of a jam. That happens in churches all the time. Somebody's marriage is falling apart. All of a sudden they're in church. You haven't seen them for years. Oh, God. And then God graciously answers prayer. And you know what happens? You won't see him again. So people may come to Jesus to help them with a few problems. They may come for assistance from time to time. But when the problem goes away or the need isn't pressing, they'll forget about him. These people need to be reminded, Peter says, about sin and God's judgment on sin. They need to be reminded about what comes after this life. And for all these reasons, God's left these road signs. Now, we don't always see God's judgment enacted immediately upon the commission of the transgression. And that's why Peter says the church should remember that God's judgment isn't sleeping. It's not idle. That's verse 3. Make sure you tell people, Peter says. Point number 4. As surely as God knows how to punish the wicked, he knows how to preserve the righteous. What a great truth. Verses 7 and 9. And if he rescued righteous Lot, greatly distressed by the sensual conduct of the wicked, for as that righteous man lived among them day after day, he was tormenting his soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials. He knows how to rescue the godly from trials, and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. So there's two pictures of divine rescue in this chapter. We looked at one of them. God saved Noah and his family out of the flood. And then God preserved Lot in the middle of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot gets a lot of bad press. I mean, he made some bad choices. He was selfish. And so, sure, there are certainly blemishes. But in these two examples, Peter outlines two traits of character that bring God's blessing and protection in the middle of a time of sin and projected judgment. He says, here are the two examples. Noah, first, he was a herald of righteousness. It's in verse 5. A herald of righteousness. For 120 years, isn't it something for 120 years when nobody listens to you, and after 120 years you haven't changed your message one bit? I'd say to you, that is unheard of in today's world. Someone should have said, Noah, this is not playing well. I'm in marketing. Noah starts telling people, it's going to be a flood. God is going to judge. His own family are the only ones that will listen to him. And after 120 years, he's still saying exactly the same thing. Peter says God looks at that as just this herald of righteousness. Even though nobody else shared that message, even though nobody else believed that message, even though nobody else responded to that message. Let me tell you, if you're here, Christian, you're going to university, I just described you. No one's going to believe your message. No one's going to hear your message, and not very many people are going to respond to it. Like, make up your mind now, how are you going to handle that? The second example is Lot. Lot kept his soul sensitive to the ugliness of sin. That, too, is very difficult. Peter says, verse 8, Lot was tormenting his righteous soul over their lawless deeds that he saw and heard. So whatever his weaknesses may have been, the text says that he was just tormented in his soul at the wickedness of the people around him. Not the suffering of the people around him. We're all moved by that. Not the suffering. That's not what tormented his soul. The wickedness tormented his soul. And I would submit to you that that's always an indicator of the state of the heart. How do you feel about the wickedness of this world? Peter says, godly people bleed inside. The psalmist says, my eyes are filled with tears because they do not keep your law. I can't stop crying, the psalmist says. I wake up at night bawling. Why? The people don't honor God. Don't see that much anymore, do you? You don't see that much anymore. Wicked people don't just do bad things. Paul says they actually begin to take delight in those who do them. That's Romans 1:32. Though they know God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. They do pride parades. They muster support. When people turn from the truth to practice sin, hear me. When people turn from the truth to practice sin, they always apply pressure to get others to join with them. That is the nature of sin. In today's world, it happens primarily through the media, in a mass sense. Sin is made humorous and light and trendy and not that serious. You know how long can people watch? I don't even know. How long can people watch Sex and the City on TV and continue to be brokenhearted at sin? It's not possible. It's not possible. Don't let the crowd, sometimes even the religious crowd, blunt the voice of shame and pain when the spirit is grieved by sin. Let me close with just final word, not of judgment, but of encouragement. We got one more minute. Peter says, God knows how to keep you from falling. It's in 2 Peter 2, verse 9. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from his trials. The Lord knows how to rescue the godly from his trials. Don't let the sins of others discourage your heart. Don't let the sins of others, even if it's the majority, don't let those things weaken your confidence in the truth. It happens. You can start to look in your own soul very sincerely. What makes me think I'm right when everybody else seems to be changing his mind? What makes me think this standard is sure when everybody else seems to be moving it? What makes me think I can stand when so many other people seem to be falling? Remember that promise. The Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and how to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. I'm glad. I'm glad that God knows how to do those two things at exactly the same time. God doesn't settle all scores in this present age. His judgment is not idle, and he's not asleep. He who keeps you will not slumber. Psalm 20. He's not asleep, and he hasn't forgotten, and judgment is coming. And by the way, if you'll keep your trust in him, he also knows how to keep you. Even if the whole world is against you, he knows how to keep you from falling.